Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 196 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Mr. Gibby, what is going on with you?
What's happening, man? How are you doing?
Doing pretty good.
Yeah.
How you doing?
How you doing?
Excited to get into this episode. Before we do that, we have a new episode out right now on True Crime All the Time. We're talking about Carol Edward Colt. Serial killer. Wow, Gibbs, this guy, he was something else.
He really was. It was a rough case, but man.
Yeah, it was rough. You know, you're talking about a man who murdered a large number of women. He has said maybe as high as 35. I don't think, you know, obviously that number's not been confirmed, but it's the reason why he says he murdered.
Yeah.
Right, to get revenge on his mother for what she did to him as a child, that really makes this case so fascinating.
It's also what he does after he kills some of these victims.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we are talking about some cannibalism, some necrophilia. It was rough, no doubt about it.
It really was.
We have some new Patreon supporters. Let's give some shout outs. We had Lovisa Ingemandardotter.
Yeah. There you go.
Casey Blanchard.
Hey, Casey.
Calista Shaben.
Hey, thanks, Calista.
Ashes.
Well, appreciate that, Ash.
LaDonna Crab.
What's going on, LaDonna?
Kate Basting.
Hey, Kate.
Lauren Peters.
Thank you, Lauren.
Hannah Cox.
Appreciate that, Hannah.
Nikki Woods.
What's up, Nikki?
Morgan Hancock.
Well, thank you, Morgan.
Sandy Murphy.
Well, Murphy.
Ray Daly.
Good old Ray.
Brandon Wilkinson.
Appreciate that, Brandon.
Lisa Huffins.
The Huffins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kate Legally.
Thank you, Kate.
Legally. I'm still on the fence.
Yeah.
Aaron Abers.
Well, appreciate that, Aaron.
Bridget Clausen.
Hey, what's going on, Bridget?
Robin Anderson.
Thank you, Robin.
Ava Iani.
Yanni.
Rebecca.
Good old Rebecca.
Christy Monroe.
Thank you, Christy.
Stephanie Chavez.
What's up, Chavez?
And James Busby.
Hey, appreciate that, James.
And then if we go back into the vault. This week, we selected Sam Stephanieson.
Hey, Sam.
So we appreciate the new support, the continued support. We had some great PayPal donations, too. Daniel Javier.
Appreciate that, Daniel.
Kelly Duncan.
Hey, Kelly.
Linda McLean.
Linda.
And Julie Shantz.
Awesome, Julie.
So thank you as well. All right, buddy, are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved?
I am.
We're talking about the disappearance of 20-year-old Angela Marie Hammond, who was abducted in April of 1991 from Clinton, Missouri. It's almost 30 years later, and police still have no idea what happened to her. Before we get started, just a quick shout out to Lindsay Sklarik for her help in researching this episode. Angela Marie Hammond was born in Kansas City, Missouri on February 9th, 1971, to Chris and Marcia Hammond. In 1975, her parents decided to move to the small town of Clinton, Missouri. That's where Angela's maternal grandparents lived. In 1991, the town's population was around 9,000.
Kind of small.
Yeah, relatively small. I mean, I think that's still a town where, Yeah. A lot of people are going to know each other's business.
A lot of people talking at the coffee shop or the diner.
Now, there are towns that are much, much smaller than that. I think we had one in a recent episode that was, what, 500, 600?
Yeah.
Hell, you can't even step outside without somebody knowing it in a town that size.
People know when you get your hair cut there.
Exactly. But I think they moved in part because they felt it would be safer in this small town. Really, besides having a couple of factories, it was mostly farmland and farmers living and working there. Shortly after they moved, Angela's younger brother, Lauren, was born. But Angela's parents started having marital issues, and they eventually separated and then divorced. Her dad, Chris, moved to Olathe, Kansas, about 80 miles west of Clinton. And Marcia moved to a new home as well in Montrose, Missouri. Montrose was only about 20 minutes from Clinton, so still pretty close to her parents. And from everything in the research gives, it really seems as though Angela and her brother had a pretty happy post-divorce life with their parents.
Which is good, right? I mean, because
it's always good.
There's a lot of times you hear the opposite.
Well, absolutely, right? If two people who are married can't get along and they have kids, sometimes they let that split affect their relationship with their kids.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to be the case here, at least from everything that you and I read. Obviously, it's always better if you can do it that way.
Well, sure. Yeah. If you can keep the kids happy. I mean, you came from a divorced family, so.
No, I did. And my parents got along reasonably well.
Yeah.
Well enough so that I never really noticed any animosity. And so that didn't rub down on me, which was a good thing.
Absolutely.
Her family and friends said that as Angela got older and was able to drive, she would cruise over to the town of Clinton a lot because, you know, she had a lot of friends there. And I guess, Gib, she had a pretty nice 1987 red Ford Mustang to do all that cruising in.
Be fun to do.
Well, who doesn't like to go cruising? Especially if you got a little peppy Mustang.
Yeah. Give me one. Let me go cruise it.
Friends and family also said that Angela had an outgoing personality. She was fun-loving, and she was a very intelligent young woman. She was always very energetic. She was described as a little firecracker.
Well, when you're 4'11".
That was part of it.
Yeah.
Yep. 4'11", very energetic. Okay. You're going to get nicknames like firecracker.
Yeah.
In November of 1990, 19-year-old Angela began dating 18-year-old Rob Schaefer. Rob was a high school senior. He was also an all-star athlete with plans to join the military once he graduated high school. At this time, when Angela and Rob started dating, Angela was attending classes at Central Missouri State University, and she was also working at night for the Union State Bank in Clinton as a processor. Just 2 months later, the couple found out that Angela was pregnant, and Rob proposed to Angela. He was excited to care for his soon-to-be family. The baby was due on September 2nd, 1991. So Rob planned to join the military and undergo basic training before the baby came. Their extended families were excited for the baby, and they offered to help the young couple with baby care after the baby was born, which is awesome. And that's something that my wife and I experienced as well. We had a lot of family.
Who doesn't love to help with a baby?
Sure. So when we had, you know, our first child, it was like we had a plethora of help.
Yeah.
I mean, we had so much help that we didn't even need it all, but we took it.
You know what I like to help? I like to help with the baby. And when the baby starts acting up,
mm-hmm. Give it right back.
Yeah.
Or does a little poo-poo.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, here's your baby back.
Angela's mother, Marcia, planned for a spring family barbecue at her house on April 4th, 1991. It turned out to be a very nice day for a cookout with temperatures in the high 70s. Marcia told the press later that on the night of April 4th, around 9 p.m., Angela, Rob, and their friend Kyla left the barbecue party to take Rob home. He had to babysit his little brother for the night in Clinton. His mother told him to be home by 10 p.m. Angela was supposed to meet him later, around 11:30 p.m., once Rob's mom returned that night. After dropping Rob off, Kyla and Angela cruised around downtown Clinton, having some fun. Angela dropped Kyla off at her home around 11:15 p.m., telling Kyla she was too exhausted to hang out with Rob later, and she just wanted to go home, get into bed, and get some sleep.
Well, she is pregnant.
That's true.
You know, it's just sitting there exhausts you when you're pregnant. So I
are you speaking from experience? Because I don't know where that experience is coming from.
From what I understand and hear.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good caveat to add.
Yes.
Unless you were involved in some type of twin situation like Arnold and Danny DeVito that I'm not aware of.
Which, you know, if it paid right, I would give it a try.
All right. You are on your own on that. I watched my wife go through two of them.
No. I wouldn't want to do that.
No. You and I are not strong enough, dude. Men are not strong enough to go through that.
Yeah.
Women are way stronger than we are.
I'll go ahead and just get my belly big the natural way. I'll eat it there.
The way that it was intended?
Yes.
Kyla later said that Angela told her she was going to drive to a payphone nearby to call Rob to let him know that she would not be stopping by and instead was going home to sleep. Angela stopped at the payphone located about 7 blocks from where Rob lived. The payphone was in the center of downtown at 210 South 2nd Street at the corner in the Food Barn store parking lot. And there were two payphones at this location. According to police records, she called Rob around 11:25 p.m. Rob later said that during the phone call, Angela said she was done for the night. She was going to go home and go to bed. They talked for a little bit, and then around 11:45 p.m., Angela told Rob someone was circling the block in an old green pickup truck. And Gibbs, I think this is the first of probably many things that people dissect when they look at this case, the timing of these phone calls and kind of questioning, okay, if Angela was tired and she wanted to go home and go to bed, why was she on the phone so long?
Sure.
With Rob? And then I think another question is, all right, she was only, what, 7 blocks from his house?
Yeah.
Why not just drive over real quick and tell him face to face, or drive the roughly 20 minutes home and call him from home
and say, hey, I'm home. I'm sorry. I'm just way too tired.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a question that people kind of ask as related to this case. It's not going to be the only question.
No,
there's a number that are going to pop up.
And I always think if something like this happened in today's world, how much different would be. Because you wouldn't stop the call, right? You would just pick up your cell phone and either text or call and say, hey, I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Yeah, you just do it while you were driving.
Yeah.
Boom, 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 cell phone. Hey, not stopping by. I'm driving home. I'll talk to you tomorrow. But it's 1991.
Right.
And I know for a fact I didn't have a cell phone in 1991. Yeah. That was the year that I graduated. There were cell phones, I believe, but they were not commonplace at all. Yeah. I think even then it was probably more for rich people, or it was the bricks, or it was the ones that were plugged into your car.
Right. Just not convenient.
Yeah. I don't know when that first kind of Motorola flip phone came out, but I know for a fact I didn't have one in 1991.
Yeah. I don't remember when I got my first, but
yeah, I don't either, but I was a senior in high school in 1991. So I know I didn't have it.
No, that was the least of your worries anyway.
Angela described this truck as looking like a Ford F-150. She also told Rob it had a mural of a fish jumping out of the water on the rear window.
Kind of reminds me of that logo from Bass Pro Shops.
Yeah, yeah, it could have been. Who knows? But their logo is something like that, yeah. Right? There's a fish or there's something. She then told Rob the truck was driving in the parking lot, and it was headed towards her and the payphones. She said the truck parked by the phone booth. The driver got out. He was a scruffy, kind of filthy looking man with a whitish beard, and he was wearing overalls and glasses. She said to Rob that the man walked right up to the booth next to her. He attempted to use the phone, but hung up the receiver as if it was not working. Angela asked the man if he needed to use the phone she was on. He said he would try again later, and then he returned to his truck. Angela told Rob that the man was sitting in his truck looking for something using a flashlight. So Rob and Angela are having this conversation, right? It's continuing on.
Yeah.
And then just a few minutes later, Rob heard a scream. And then he heard what he thought was the phone hitting the side of the phone booth. He told the police and the local press later that once he heard the scream that he believed to be Angela, he jumped into action. He dropped the phone from his hand, ran out the door, jumped into his truck, and sped away as fast as he could towards the payphone location.
I think a lot of people will try to do that.
We mentioned it, right? It's only 7 blocks away. It's not an hour away.
No. You actually have an opportunity to maybe help the situation out.
On the way, he saw a truck speeding towards him with what looked like a struggling woman in the cab. And Rob said, as the truck passed, he heard Angela scream out his name. So he immediately threw the truck in reverse, spun the truck around, and he began to chase this truck. First on to 2nd Street, then on to Culvert Drive. But there's always a problem with very quickly throwing your car into reverse.
Yeah, it's not good for the transmission.
No, transmissions don't like it. Rob said his transmission gave out. And that was it, right? His truck stopped. He said that all he could do was stand there staring at the other truck's taillights, heading off into the dark, knowing that Angela and their unborn baby was inside.
Had to be a heart-wrenching feeling. Helplessness.
Yeah. The helpless type of feeling, the panic, the fact that you just can't do anything.
Yeah.
After that, Rob said he flagged down a passing motorist who picked him up, and he asked the motorist to rush him to the police station. So this was around midnight by the time this happened. And when he got to the police, he told them that the truck was a Ford, greenish yellow, and maybe it had a white cab. He also said it had a damaged driver's side front fender. And he talked about the rear window decal with the fish on it.
So pretty observant.
Yeah, pretty good, I think, for that type of frantic situation, right? Always makes it tougher. Rob gave the police a description of the man driving the truck. He said he had a full beard and a mustache, glasses, was wearing a dark-colored baseball hat, and he had on overalls. I don't know, Gibbs, if I drive, you know, 3 or 4 miles, I might see 4 people that match that description.
Well,
where I live.
I would say, depending on what town you're in, right? It could be every corner, but again, it's a pretty good description.
Oh, yes. I mean, every detail counts, right? The more details you're able to relay to the police, the better. The Clinton police detective called Marcia that night, and he had to tell her that her daughter had possibly been abducted and that she should contact Angela's father so that both of them could come to the police station in the morning. Angela's father was there in less than 2 hours.
Yeah, I don't think he was going to wait till the morning to get there. He was going to get up there as soon as he could. And he was only 80 miles away. Well, depending on how fast he drove, traffic probably didn't take him all that long.
Well, and my thought, Gibbs, is that if somebody calls you and tells you your daughter was abducted, you're probably not obeying all the speed limits.
No.
You're putting the hammer down.
Yeah.
And if somebody pulls you over, F it. I don't care.
Well, they're not going to pull me over until I get where I need to be.
Yeah, you'll have to chase me all the way to the police station, and then we can sort it out there. Well, and as soon as he got there, he, Marcia, and Rob drove around looking for Angela. The police did find Angela's car at the phone booth location, and her purse was still inside it. on the front seat. Police also confirmed that Rob's truck was broken down on the side of the road where he said it was. Now, of course, Gibbs, Rob came under suspicion at first. It's always going to happen that way. We've talked about it in almost every case.
Yeah, significant other always is the first up.
Yeah, throw in the fact that, you know, right now they're not married. They have a baby on the way. All right, you have some things to look at as far as reasons possibly why Rob would want to get out of this relationship or would want, you know, something to happen to Angela. You at least, as the police, have to look at it. And I think to a lot of people, his story sounded strange, almost bordering on the point of unbelievable. This chase.
Yeah.
No one else saw it. There were no witnesses as they were, you know, kind of going through town. Now, granted, it was midnight or somewhere around there. Then you have his transmission going out at this critical moment, right, as he's giving chase.
And he was really good with all these details, you know, the color of the truck, the decal, what the driver looked like. But then he chased the truck for a while, but he never got the license plate number. So that was an issue for some people. How could you not remember what the license plate number was if you were behind it for a while?
And I get that. I get that because you would look at the situation outside of the frantic chase that he's in and say, well, that's the most important thing.
Yeah.
Because that would be the thing that would most likely help police find out who owns this vehicle, which will probably be the driver.
Yeah.
And is the best lead to finding Angela. But like I said, in a very frantic situation.
Yes.
I always have to think about that because you don't know how you're going to act. You don't know how someone should act. You don't know how rational the thinking is when you're in this panic kind of stricken mode.
There's no checklist to follow.
No. No, I'm sure if he had somebody else with him and they said, hey, get the license plate number.
Right.
All right, I get that. But if you're just got the hammer down and you're chasing and...
Yeah, he was just trying to get Angela back.
Yeah, I get it why people would question it. But at the same time, you have to be careful because it's very easy to do the Monday morning quarterback thing and say, well, you should have done this, you should have done that. Well, we don't know what we would have done in that situation. You always want to think that you'll MacGyver it. You'll Jason Bourne it.
Yeah.
You'll make all the right split decisions, but in real life, it doesn't always happen that way.
No.
I can't believe I just compared MacGyver to Jason Bourne, but...
Hey, MacGyver was a bad dude, man.
Yeah, he was. Maybe because I always think of MacGruber when I think of MacGyver now.
Yeah, that's a different...
That is a much different character. Okay, I'll stick with my MacGyver. Now, Rob was interrogated several times. He was given a voice stress test and a polygraph test, and he passed both of them. He ended up being fully cleared after police were able to fully corroborate his story. The woman who brought him to the police station said she actually saw the truck while it was parked next to Angela's Mustang. Angela's mother, Marcia, and her friend Kyla never doubted that Rob was telling the truth. They knew that he loved Angela and their unborn baby. As the police investigated Angela's abduction, they had two witnesses come forward telling them that they saw Angela at the phone booth staring near what they described as a green 1969 Ford pickup truck. They also described a water scene mural on the back window. They gave a description of the driver as a man wearing a dark-colored baseball cap. He had a mustache. Later, other witnesses told police they saw the same truck and driver driving through town that evening, except they didn't see that the driver had a beard, but he had long hair, and they said he was in his late 20s to early 30s. So we do have some differing descriptions of who was driving this green truck. The descriptions of the truck are all very similar, but the descriptions of the man driving it, depending on the time, are different. Now, technically, you could have two different people driving this truck at the different times the witnesses are saying they saw them.
Yeah. I just don't know how people can give that good of detail descriptions, because I could never do that. I know we talked about that before. I could look at somebody and the next day, I don't know if I could give that type of description. I just don't think I could.
Really? Because I didn't find these descriptions to be all that detailed.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying, if I saw a truck driving around, I might look at it and, oh, there's a truck. But I'm not going to remember that driver had dark hair, had a baby. I'm just not going to remember that.
But you're a horrible detective.
It's true.
No, I get you. I mean, it definitely makes sense, because you don't pay attention to details when there's no reason to pay attention to details.
Right.
And the problem is, once you realize that you need the details, it's too late, because the time has passed and you didn't pay attention. So in that sense, I understand what you're saying. I guess from my point of view, you know, describing somebody as wearing a dark cap and having a mustache, okay, that's pretty thin as far as descriptions go.
Right. But like you said, that could fit so many different possibilities. And
you mean anybody that was wearing a dark cap and had a mustache?
Exactly. Yeah. It also makes me think of Cousin Vinny, you know.
Or Cousin Vinny, as I like to call him.
Yeah, yeah. And how they give their description.
Where he badgers that woman about how thick her glasses are.
And, yeah.
Investigators contacted the FBI for assistance with this case pretty early on. The Missouri State Police also called in the Missouri Rural Crime Squad to search for the described truck in the DMV system. They ended up, Gibbs, with over 1,600 possibilities.
It's a lot.
It is a lot. They attempted to cross-reference and visit the owners. That's a lot of manpower.
It is.
But these leads didn't turn up any viable suspects. Angela's workplace, Union State Bank, offered a $5,000 reward, and her friends and family contributed $11,000 to make the total $16,000. The local state police and the FBI search for Angela in and around the area. On April 8th, 4 days after she went missing, over 250 volunteers, along with the police, searched the woods and fields of the town of Clinton and Henry County, looking for the man, looking for the truck, but they didn't find anything. They didn't find the man. They didn't find the truck. They didn't find Angela. Rob stated to the local press, "I just want to find her. I haven't lost hope." Well, I hope not after 4 days. I mean, I get what he's saying.
Right.
But if you've lost hope after 4 days, then that's not a good sign.
No.
But he hasn't, so with that. The investigators ended up with over 500 leads over the next 6 months, but no suspects, let alone a person of interest.
So that's a lot of leads.
To not develop one person of interest? Yeah. Rob had committed to the military by that time, gone off to boot camp for the National Guard as planned. He had a tough time. His girlfriend, his unborn baby had been abducted. He had no idea if they were alive or dead.
And that's a lot to handle as a young man.
Well, and boot camp's a lot to handle.
Yeah.
And you put those two together, that must have been a pretty rough time. And I think, Gibbs, what would make it even more tough is, you're 6 months on, you know, and a lot of people around town by that point had suspected that they were most likely dead. And that's not, you know, a speculation that is too far out of the box. I mean, 6 months is a very long time.
It's a harsh possibility.
Yeah. I mean, you're not saying for sure, but in the back of most people's minds, you have to begin to think, if somebody hasn't shown up in 6 months,
right,
something really bad happened. So Rob went off to training. The communication with Angela's family kind of stopped. There was the occasional call now and then. But even Angela's mother, Marcia, told the Kansas City Star that it was time for the family to move on with their lives. But at the same time, they would never give up on Angela.
No, but eventually you got to get to that point where you're like, we'll do everything we can, but we also have to move forward and live.
Yeah, because I would think, you know, for a long period of time, everything just stops, right? Your life essentially stops.
Yeah.
And the only thing that you're involved with is looking for your daughter. She told the paper, I guess you think time will heal everything, but we're 6 months down the road now, and I'm still not any better. It's still just a roller coaster of emotions. She went on to say that she was going to head off to Florida for a vacation to get away from the area.
She probably wanted to get away so she didn't see everything that reminded her of her daughter in that community.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And never having been in that situation myself, I would never tell a parent or never say a parent was doing the right thing, the wrong thing. I do think for me, though, it would be tough to leave the area knowing she could potentially still be out there.
Yeah.
Now, if there was some tip that said maybe she was in Florida, I'll go to Florida. If there was a tip that said she was in Puerto Wherever. Rico, I'll go there. Yeah. But that's just me. I can't sit here and say that a parent is wrong for doing that.
No, we've had it where people moved on and did other things. We've had people just need to take a little break. We've had it where, I remember one case we had where the mom sat by the phone and never left that couch where the phone was. She just sat there day in and day out just in case someone called.
And let's be honest, at a certain point, you know, some of those behaviors are not healthy.
Right.
You're probably not eating. You're not taking care of yourself. And, you know, that's the other side of the coin.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to find your daughter, but you have to take care of yourself as well.
Yeah, if you don't, you're not going to be able to help find your daughter.
Yeah, both mentally and physically. As the case started to go cold, the state investigators and FBI began to investigate a theory that Angela's disappearance could be related to two other disappearances in the surrounding area. Trudy Darby of Max Creek and Cheryl Ann Kinney of Nevada, Missouri, both towns about an hour drive from each other. Both towns were also about an hour away from Clinton. So it's kind of like a triangle type scenario, Gibbs. On April 8th, 1991, it was reported in the Daily Journal that FBI spokesman Jeff Lanza said, the possibility that all are related is only a theory at this point, but one we are investigating. It was also stated that there was nothing definitive to connect to crimes at that point, but they deserve to be investigated.
Well, at this point, they have nothing to lose.
Yeah, they got no other leads. They got no suspects, no persons of interest. Trudy Darby was robbed and then abducted on January 19th, 1991, from the local convenience store in Max Creek. Max Creek is a small town. In 1991, they had about 500 people. So obviously much, much smaller than Clinton.
Yeah.
It was 2 days later when Trudy's body was found in the local river. The autopsy determined she had been sexually assaulted and then shot in the head twice. During the investigation, they determined that the suspect stole $220 from the store. During that night, Trudy was on the phone with her son, telling him she saw a suspicious man outside the store who she said was just wandering around aimlessly. Her son, being concerned, told her that he would drive up to the store to check it out. He only lived about 10 minutes away, but when he got there, the store was empty. His mom was gone. And her coat was left behind the counter.
Alarming.
Yeah, as a son, you're very alarmed that you were talking to her just 10 minutes ago and now she's gone.
Well, and the store also looked like it had been robbed.
Which would add to the alarm, for sure. Trudy's case was investigated initially, but also went cold, still with the police and FBI looking into it again since Angela's disappearance. Some of her family had hoped that some new leads would be developed. The other case police and FBI were revisiting was the disappearance of Cheryl Ann Kinney. She was last seen on February 27th, 1991. She was closing the convenience store where she worked when she was taken. The police found the store locked with her car parked nearby, but Cheryl was nowhere to be found. During the investigation of the three women, investigators told the press that Cheryl might have left on her own because they learned she was depressed over the loss of her mother, but at the same time, they doubted that she would leave her husband, her two children, and her recently widowed dad behind and just take off.
Plus, she left her car behind. And according to her husband, she only had about $10 on her. So I think it's kind of far-fetched that she left on her own accord.
Yeah, I think if you add all that together, it doesn't make any sense, right? Unless she had a stash of money that she'd been squirreling away that no one knew about. Right. Where are you going to get with no car and $10?
But then you have to say, well, she's the type of person that would leave her kids.
And by all accounts, police didn't think she was. And let's face it, most mothers aren't.
Right.
I mean, that's just a fact. The investigators were informed in December of 1991 that someone thought they had seen a young woman matching Angela's description inside a drugstore in Manitoba, Canada. The witness saw her leave the store and get into a pickup truck, then drive off. The Canadian RMP investigated this, but really nothing else came from it. And I think that happens quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know, when you talked about it's tough to think that you would remember details. Well, the flip side of that for me is I also think it's kind of easy to see someone and think that they look like a picture that you've seen on television or sure. That's been posted, you know, false sightings. Happen quite often.
I mean, there's many doppelgangers out there for everybody, right? I was up in Tip City when my niece called and she was in Springboro in the hardware store. And I answered and she said, "Do you see me?" I'm like, "I don't see you." She goes, "I'm standing in the aisle behind you." I said, "I'm nowhere where there's an aisle." And then realized that she saw somebody that looked like me. And she, being my niece, seeing me, you know, for 20 some years, thought it was me.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. So you can see how people can make identity mistakes.
Yeah. And that would be a really good story if anyone listening knew where either Tip City or Springboro was. Yeah.
Well,
I thought maybe you would say I was 40 minutes away.
Yeah, exactly. That would have been easier.
It would have been more descriptive.
Yes.
But it still highlights your point.
Yeah.
In June of 1992, the state police and the FBI had another case to worry about, the Springfield Three. That case involved Suzanne Streeter, Stacy McCall, and Suzanne's mother, Cheryl Levitt, who all disappeared from Susie's home in Springfield, Missouri. Stacy's mother, Janice, was the one who discovered they were missing. Months later, Janice reached out to Marcia Hammond for advice, and the two of them became good friends. Gibbs, they shared something that most other people could never understand. They would never want to understand, but they were both thrown into this situation. Janice even told the Springfield News, "It's not a bond you want to have, but at least there's someone else going through this." And this Springfield 3 case, Gibbs, it's a big case. It's something we'll do later on Unsolved at some point.
But I also understand what Janice was saying. I get that. It's a strange bond, but a needed bond.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you hate that there's somebody else that has the same thing going on that you do. But man, what a support system, because there's only so many people that have gone through this.
Yeah.
And to, you know, find someone somewhat local that you can talk to, that had to have been huge.
Yeah, because you always have those people say, I understand what you're going through.
Yeah, but they never do.
No, because you didn't go through.
People use that all the time.
Yeah. Until you go through what I actually went through, you don't know.
And most often times, you don't want to go through what that other person's gone through. In 1992, the show Unsolved Mysteries aired an episode about Angela Hammond. The airing prompted over 700 calls to authorities, but again, Gibbs, none were really substantial. No leads were developed, tips, suspects, nothing.
What amount of calls, though? 700.
Well, and I think you and I have mentioned this, right? Getting on Unsolved Mysteries, getting on shows like America's Most Wanted.
Yeah.
It's huge for some of these cases because the more eyeballs you get on a case, or in our situation, the more ears that you get on a case, it can only increase the chances that someone out there has seen something. Maybe they didn't know what it was. Well, now this show puts the whole thing into context and they're going to call and say, oh my gosh, I have this information. Hopefully it will help.
Right. And you're right. And sometimes it will help, right? If that little bit of information is the connection between some other information. But obviously in this case, it didn't.
Then in the spring of 1993, investigators received a tip from a psychic about a farm in Lafayette County, Missouri. The psychic told them the green Ford truck was buried on that property. So authorities brought out 5 cadaver dogs. And they had 20 police officers search the entire property, but no truck or human remains were found at the site.
Again, a disappointment.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, when you're dealing with these unsolved cases, it does seem like disappointment after disappointment. Yeah. Wow, your hopes are up. Police have this tip. This is going to be the one.
Right.
And then it's a huge letdown when they don't find anything. In 1994, 2 half-brothers, Jesse Rush and Marvin Chaney, were arrested for the abduction, rape, and murder of Trudy Darby. The break in the case came from a friend that reported Jesse Rush told her what they had done to Trudy back in 1991. This person hadn't come forward because Jesse threatened her life. She was afraid. Police tapped the phones in her house. And she was able to get Rush to confess on tape in September of 1994. He also implicated his half-brother, Chaney, but Chaney denied the claims. Marvin's wife provided him an alibi, saying that he was home with her that night. In 1996, Rush was convicted and received a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. I think Gibbs, police believed that Marvin Chaney was involved.
They did.
They thought he was connected possibly to some other murders across the state as well. And so they approached his wife again with some new details. And this time she confessed that back then she had lied for him. So in 1997, Marvin Chaney pled guilty to the murder of Trudy Darby. He too was sentenced to life without parole. And he was not a good guy. He was involved in a slew of different crimes.
Yeah, he was bad.
Before he pleaded guilty to the murder of Trudy Darby, he was convicted of child abuse. But neither man has ever been connected to Angela Hammond. But I think you can see why a lot of people speculate that these two could be involved with Angela's disappearance. When you look at their mugshots, you see 2 men, both with beards and mustaches. They also had long hair.
Yeah. And like you said, it's probably a very common look in that area.
I mean, not to say that everyone looks the same in an area, but you know, when you're in a rural town,
right?
There's definitely a different vibe going on as opposed to, you know, driving down Rodeo Drive. It's, you're not going to see the same type of fashion, the same type of haircuts, the same type of look. It's just a different place with a different vibe. Chaney died in prison before he could be officially connected to any other murders. But like I said, I do believe Gibbs, and police have stated this, they think he was involved with more murders, but there's nothing they can do now.
Yeah, he's gone.
Rush wrote letters to another inmate where he detailed crimes and confessed about some of the remote places he and his half-brother would dump bodies. But that in and of itself doesn't really prove anything. It doesn't help the authorities prove anything.
Well, unless they can go to those remote locations, actually find a body there, it's not going to help anything.
Next, we have to talk about serial killer Kenneth McDuff. He was known to be in and around the area of Clinton, Missouri in 1991, and then moved to Kansas City in 1992. And this is a guy we haven't profiled yet on TCAB, but I'm sure we will at some point. I don't think there's any doubt, Gibbs. This guy was an active killer during those years before he was arrested and convicted in that area. But as far as I know, there's no evidence that has him in the area where Angela went missing on the night she went missing.
But he fits that profile.
He does. Unfortunately, there's probably quite a few people that fit that profile. You know, I think what's really tragic right now in this case, we already talked about Trudy Darby. Neither Angela Marie Hammonds nor Cheryl Ann Kinney has ever been found. On April 4th, 2009, Police Sergeant Paul Abbott told the Springfield News that they were hoping technology could provide a break in Angela's case. Now, he didn't detail the evidence that had been preserved, but he did say they had several items that were being reprocessed. So they were hopeful they could develop some DNA profiles that could possibly be identified in the future. I think the problem for us is there just really hasn't been any updates on the DNA, but hopefully someday it will be matched.
Yeah, I mean, it is highly possible based on other cases that we've covered in the past and recently, and they've been solved because of the DNA.
On June 17th, 2010, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon signed a proclamation making June 17th Angela Marie Hammond Day. Rob still stays in touch with Angie's family. He got married and he had children, but he has said to a number of outlets that he still holds out hope. Someday she'll be found, and that her killer will be brought to justice. If you have any information concerning this case, please contact the Clinton Police Department. It's 660-885-5561. So it's a tragic case, Gibbs. And then some of the other ones that we talked about that, you know, had tenuous links to it are tragic as well. You know, when it comes to the case of Angela Marie Hammond, the case is so cold and it's so old that, you know, we talked about DNA.
Yeah.
There's a good chance that at some point in time, they may be able to match that DNA and find out who took Angela. But in my mind, she's gone.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I mean, we're 30 years.
Yeah.
Later.
And more than 500 plus leads, 700 plus phone calls. And they looked at all the bad individuals in and around the area. And there was some really bad guys. But again, nothing to connect them to her. It's a long time, 30 years.
Yeah. Now, but I get how family would hold out hope. And I would too.
Sure.
If I was in that situation. But just trying to be logical about it, 30 years is such a long time.
Yeah.
That I won't say there's no chance, but I will say the chances are very slim, I would think, that she's alive. But there's a much better chance that through technology, they may be able to figure out who did whatever they did to her.
Strong possibility.
And at the very least, I would think identifying the person who caused this,
yeah,
that would be huge for the family. You know, bringing that type of justice, that's not nothing.
No.
That's a big deal.
It is a huge deal.
But that's it for the disappearance of Angela Marie Hammond. We got some voicemails, Gibbs. You want to check those out?
Let's check them out.
Hey, Mike and Gibby. This is Matt from Pennsylvania. I have been absolutely taken over by your podcast, True Crime All the Time and Unsolved. Helped me through the pain that was the COVID-19 pandemic. And just wanted to let you guys know you're great. I sit and listen to you all the time while I'm working, and it really makes my time go by. I wanted to thank you for allowing me to listen and be a part of what you do. I also wanted to suggest an episode for The Unsolved. In the Philadelphia area, back in 2005, two people went missing without a trace, dropped off the face of the earth, Danielle Imbo and Richard Petrone. It was investigated by the FBI, and there's a lot of speculation about what happened, including mob ties. So if you take a look at it, it's a pretty interesting case, and has kept the Philadelphia region real interested for the past 15 plus years. So I hope you take a look at this, and thank you guys again for everything you do. You're appropriately amusing, and always keep the victims in mind, which I think is great as a former prosecutor, and really enjoy your show. So continue the good work. And always enjoy listening to you guys. Stay well. Thanks. Bye.
Wow. Gibbs, that's a lot of great kudos. We appreciate that. And really a great case to check into. And like yourself, a former prosecutor.
I can go after the Philly mob case.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Hi, Fergie and Gibby. This is Natalie from Indianapolis. I'm a newer listener. A coworker told me about you guys. Shout out to Taylor. I've been binge listening. I enjoy Unsolved too. I'm team both of you. It wouldn't be the same without your back and forth using in different opinions. Thank you for helping me get through the workday and making door dashing less boring. I love you guys. Stay safe and healthy and keep your own time ticking. Bye.
Well, that's appropriate because I am literally just about to DoorDash something the minute you leave here.
Yeah.
I'm starving.
Do you ever reach your hand in and grab a fry? Do you? It's okay. You can admit it.
You're talking to her, right? Because you know I did.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
Hey, Mike and Gibby. My name is Debbie Doyle, and I am calling from Charleston, South Carolina. And I'm a longtime listener, but I just wanted to let you know that you guys have certainly made me keep my head on a swivel. I'm a teacher, so I'm hitting the gym at 5 a.m. where it's dark. I'm coming out. It's dark. And I have been known to call the non-emergency police department line on occasion for certain vehicles that are in the gym parking lot. So thanks for everything that you do. You guys are awesome. I always laugh out loud, and I'm sure all the people at the gym think I'm a little bit crazy. But be safe and keep your own time ticking. Thanks.
Well, I think it's important. You know, I've talked about it a lot.
Yeah.
Keeping your head on a swivel, not being too paranoid, but just that right amount that doesn't negatively affect your life, but keeps you on your toes a little bit.
Got to be on your toes, man.
Now, what I will say is if you don't already have one, you should go out to the website and get one of the True Crime All the Time safety whistles.
You love those whistles.
They're so loud. If someone is too close to you and you blow that whistle, they're going to turn around and run.
I know. Because I do it here all the time. Yeah.
Hey, Mike and Gibby. It's Larry from Wisconsin. I'm originally from Ohio, Cleveland, to be exact. I left a couple voicemails, and one of the voicemails was an unsolved crime about Alexis Patterson up here in Wisconsin. It's still not solved, and they don't know if she's alive, murdered, or whatnot. I guess it's been about 20 years almost, but I just came across something interesting. It's about a person called Leticia Toro, and come to find out, she was like a spy on both sides, and apparently her mother was a spy, and I guess they found Leticia dead in a rail cart, the knife sticking out her neck. They didn't see anybody come get on or off, and it was only had like 30 seconds. And I guess apparently one of the detectives started getting some clues, and he went to the higher ups and said that he thinks it was the government on their behalf, And they immediately took the officer off the case and closed the case. So I guess the case is closed for 100 years based off their laws and whatnot. I think that's something very interesting. There's a lot of famous names in there as well. The Italian Mafia and the Nazis and whatnot. This murder happened in the 1930s. I think should give it a look and hope to hear my voicemail on the podcast. Thanks. Bye.
If we're going to go after the Philly Mafia, then we can just add the Italian Mafia in there too.
Oh, yeah, because that's a piece of cake.
Yeah.
That's definitely one for you to check out, though. And we appreciate all the voicemails. We definitely do. All right, buddy. That is it for another episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.